Before we begin, just a quick note. If this conversation about alcohol, identity, and desire resonates, my new book, What Are You Thirsty For? Rethinking Alcohol and the Life You Want, is out now. And if you want to go deeper, slowly, thoughtfully, and in ways that genuinely nourish you, I've opened the Thirsty For More Mindset Lab on Substack. You'll find links to both in the show notes. Right. Let's get on with the episode. Welcome to the Big Drink Rethink, the podcast for anyone questioning their relationship with alcohol or simply wondering what more life might hold. I'm Anna Donaghy, alcohol mindset coach, author, and former strategist. And each episode is going to blend lived experience, psychological insight, and powerful tools to help you understand your habits and gently rethink your drinking in a way that throws open oodles of possibilities. So whether you're trying to quit, cut down, or you're just plain curious, then you are in the right place. Let's rethink things together and explore what you're really thirsty for. So hello, and welcome back to the Big Drink Rethink. Now, I have this thought going through my mind a lot, which is alcohol isn't powerful because it's extreme necessarily. It's powerful because it's expected. It's the backdrop, you know, rugby, football, the dinner, the celebration, the commiseration, anything actually. It's woven into social life such that we barely notice it until someone opts out. And when they do, it can feel surprisingly disruptive, totally off script. Now, I've lost count of the number of people who've told me I would kind of like to not drink, but I worry. I really worry about what's going to happen socially if I stop. And that fear is fascinating because in many cases, the social fallout people imagine never quite materializes. So today's conversation sort of sits in that tension. Why does choosing to drink, or not to drink rather, feel disruptive, and how much disruption actually happens? And meanwhile, you know, what is alcohol quietly disrupting all along? So I'm not alone today. I'm joined by Rye Gavin. Rye works with DrinkLink, a Scotland-based charity supporting people affected by someone else's drinking. Now, he's passionate about destigmatizing sobriety and challenging the expectation that alcohol is required for connection. His work focuses on the ripple effects drinking has on families and communities and what changes when we begin to see clearly without it. So, welcome to the show, Rye.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to have this chat with you.
Yeah, no, I'm stoked. This is going to be good. So is there anything you would like me to add to your intro? I know you're a non-drinker now, so you can either talk about that a little bit now or we can unfold.
I am a non-drinker now, and actually I'm coming up to my 2-year anniversary of being alcohol-free, which is, yeah, it's really, really exciting actually, you know. And the funny thing is that I never actually said I was never going to drink again. And now I'm 2 years later. You know, I actually woke up almost 2 years ago with a horrendous hangover that was just kind of crippling. You know, it's one of these kind of, you're crying at Marley and Me, you feel terrible, you know, you're having an existential crisis kind of hangover.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I thought to myself, do you know, I'm going to give up drinking for 2 months and you know, just see how I go. And then at the end of 2 months, I went, do you know what? I'll do a third. And then the third came and I just thought, do you know what? I'm just going to see how long I can go. And here we are 2 years later, and I'm now representing an alcohol charity. You know, I think it's really beautiful for me actually that this kind of decision based on, you know, feeling horrendous has now led to some wonderful opportunities and memories for me.
I love that. We always talk about how doors open when, you know, you quit drinking, how we think things might shrink, but how doors open. And so many times on this show and just in life off air, I talk to people who kind of go, I would never have imagined, you know, 2 years ago or 3 years ago or 4 years ago that I would be doing this today. And it's just, I love that because it just epitomizes the ziggy zaggy world of just how things can unfold. So, okay, well, look, I'm very glad that you're doing that work, because it's obviously how, you know, it's the connection that was made. You contacted me, and we subsequently had a lovely conversation, and I know that we're going to have another one today, which is going to be hugely useful. So let's jump in. So this fear of social disruption can keep a lot of people really stuck. I mean, clearly no one wants to intentionally blow up their social life, and the fear of friendships forged over alcohol suddenly changing can be too much. So we don't change. But you've made that shift in drinking. What did your social life look like before you quit? And did you have all of those fears yourself? I mean, I know you said a horrendous hangover compelled you to change, but did you have that? Mm-hmm. What's this going to mean?
Yeah, you know, I think when I did drink, it was always a central part of my social nights out. I think that it was part and parcel, right? You know, it was like, I'm going to a friend's house where, you know, I'm bringing some beers. I'm going to bring them this really obscure, you know, naturally fermented sour beer, you know, that's however much, you know, or it's going to the pub and having a few drinks while you're watching the football. You know, it was really interweaved. And yeah, when I quit drinking, it was one of these things that I thought I was stepping up into the unknown, right? Because, you know, you talk about it in your book, right? It becomes part of our identity, right? It becomes about, you know, it just becomes who we are. And, you know, I think it was a real fear for me of what are people going to think? What are people going to think about why I'm doing this, you know, and how am I going to be, you know, how am I going to interact without this? And, you know, I guess also, I mean, I think the first party I went to, the thing I really thought about is what am I going to do with my hands? You know, because you're so used to having your drink or your whatever. And it's also like maybe a part of your conversation, right? Like, mm-hmm. what are you drinking tonight? I've never heard of that gin, you know? And I guess it's really lazy small talk that you are able to kind of interweave in a social situation by, you know, when you have nothing else to say, you kind of can discuss the drink that someone's got and you can kind of share your opinions on it. So it was a real anxiety that I had, was this kind of fear of, you know, what am I now?
Yeah. And the not knowing what I'm going to do with my hands is a big one. It's a really big one. But I think given that obviously one could point out to someone who feels that, we'll just put a glass of something else in your hands instead. It clearly is. There is something about it being the alcohol and it being that sort of confidence, as you say, or potential, you know, connection, point of connection. So I guess you live and work in Scotland, right?
Yes, I do. I live in sunny Edinburgh, and my work covers all of Scotland, you know, so, you know, we're always trying to kind of, because I mean, Scotland has a historically bad relationship with alcohol, right? Mm. It's a meme. It's, you know, people think of Scotland, they think of drunks, they think of whiskey, you know, and it's actually maybe trying to think that there are more things about this beautiful country than alcohol.
Yeah, well, I didn't want to rake up the stereotype, but now that you've said it, that's okay. Yeah, I suppose you are, you know, a young guy quitting drinking.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for calling me young.
Anyway, I'm talking relativity here. So, you know, quitting drinking in a city which is known for it, in a country that is, as you say, quite famed or memed for it. So sports culture, big nights out, gosh, family gatherings, you know, we sometimes don't even think of those as socializing because they can sometimes come with obligation. But of course, you know, they are also sort of social events, weddings, all sorts of things. Alcohol would have been present at every single one of those for you, I'm assuming.
Oh, absolutely. It really was interwoven with every mm-hmm. event, right? From births, deaths, weddings, good times, bad times, everything, you know, is interwoven with a drink. So, and that's from, you know, like a really young age, right? I'm sure my mother will listen to this, but, you know, from like, you know, being a young teenager, you know, you're drinking, you know? Yeah. Sorry, Mom. but you know, but you know, you kind of are, and it's a real kind of a big part when you graduate uni. You know, it's popping the champagne, and you know, all of that kind of thing. It's really interwoven. So you know, I guess really, Anna, there was a point where I had to really refine myself, like who am I, you know, especially in kind of social situations when I'm not drinking.
Yeah, no, I 100% get that. And so just to be clear, you're thinking to yourself, I'm not going to drink for now, you know, certainly not whilst this hangover's going on, but certainly, you know, I'm gonna not drink. This is going to put the cat amongst the pigeons, or this is, you know, this is going to be, as we used the term at the beginning of this episode, about being disruptive. What did you think you might have been disrupting, or what do we generally think? You can bring your sort of professional world into this as well, your insights from DrinkLink. You know, what do we tend to think we're going to disrupt?
So I think we fear the awkwardness of not drinking more than we question the impact of drinking. Right. I think I was probably, and I think many people who go through this kind of journey, you know, really think about what people are going to think rather than how is the experience going to be. Because we stigmatize people who don't drink, which it sounds mad, right? You know, so if you don't drink, you become the odd one out, and it's, there must be a reason why, right? And that reason why just can't be you don't want to drink alcohol. Which is really where I kind of my passion and my mission is that I want to try and show people that there's another way, that there is such a beautiful life, and it doesn't just have to be because you've had a problem. Not to you know, blow smoke, but I really love the way that you categorize gray drinkers in your book, right? Because I think that those are the people who actually would worry about this the most. Because you probably have created problems in your life through drinking. And I think a lot of people have. And those people are probably people who would do best without alcohol. I know that is definitely the case for me. And because alcohol had caused problems in the past for me, when I did drink, that stigma and that worry was probably much bigger in my own head than it was presenting it. So yeah. You know, I thought I would kind of, yeah. You know, I think also, you know, when you're in a lot of situations, people do stigmatize people who don't drink as boring, right? Or, you know, or they think that they're going to be boring, right? You know, and I know in the past I've probably done that myself, right? I've been guilty of that. I definitely have. And because of that, you think, oh, everyone's going to think I'm boring. I'm this guy who doesn't drink, you know? And like, I guess that's definitely one of the reasons why I'm like, you know, now trying to kind of get out there and tell people that actually, you can be a really fun, you can have a really fun life without alcohol.
Have you turned into annoying fun guy?
I think I was annoying fun guy to start with, but this has just amplified it up a little bit.
No, I mean, seriously, I was thinking based on, you know, conversations I have with clients, you know, what is it we think we're going to be disrupting really? And it all goes back to the role that alcohol plays in settings, particularly group settings. So these settings, these get-togethers, they often take on a structure, a predictable structure and an expectation. So things like rounds and toasts and things like that, you know, to suddenly go, no, I'll not be in this round. You know, it's like, what? Why? So, you know, disruption. Group identity, massive one. Particularly, you know, I don't want to stereotype, but possibly particularly for the guys, you know, we're the lads who, you know, go out on Friday night, drink 8 pints, blah, 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 go for curry. We are those people. It is group identity.
Yeah.
It's a shared sort of shorthand behavior for sure. And it brings a sort of an emotional predictability to any group. Everyone's doing the same thing and everyone's pacing each other. So we're all on solid ground here together. But I think your point about gray area drinking is really interesting, because for me, one of the things which I think, you know, when someone turns around and says, I'm quitting, one of the things that really shakes up is this comfort of sameness. You know, norming is basically, well, it's permission, isn't it? It's validation. you get together, birds of a feather flock together and all that lot. You get together with your mates. And when you're in that position, you're giving each other permission to drink. You're able to look at each other and go, well, we're all the same. We can't be that bad. If we're all up to it, it can't be that bad. And we're not as bad as him over there, sort of thing. But it's why grey area drinking is so bloody prolific, because we get into these group environments and we don't disrupt them. We love the comfort of sameness.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, kind of on that point, you know, I think we kind of overestimate not drinking and underestimate drinking.
Yeah.
So, you know, the amount of problems that are actually caused by drinking rather than not drinking, I think are really underrepresented. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, if we think about every week in Scotland, there's 50 deaths that are caused by alcohol specifically. I mean, that's really alarming, right? And, you know, it kind of, you also have almost 30,000 alcohol-induced hospital admissions, right?
Mm.
So what is really the disruptor, right? You know, is it the alcohol that's the disruptor, or is it the not drinking that's the disruptor? And I think maybe we need to really start reevaluating what that is, especially in a time where, you know, the NHS in Scotland is crippled,
honestly,
and especially A&E departments, and you've got 30,000 people being admitted to hospital for alcohol-related incidents. I mean, it's madness, right?
Well, 100%. And those are some of just the reported stuff. And I do in a minute. I want to come and talk to you in a minute about some of the stuff that you see through DrinkLink as well, firsthand. So I definitely want to do that. But I just want to pick up on something you've just said, Rai. You said, you know, we overestimate the disruption that, you know, a single person deciding not to drink is going to create. How much disruption did you in reality experience when you stopped drinking?
So I think I am really, really lucky because my friends were really supportive, actually. And, you know, I've got a fantastic friend group. And I think there were first like, oh, you're not drinking. Right. Okay. Why? You know, and I'm giving up for 2 months, you know, and it was kind of left at that, which I was really, really lucky for. So in all honesty, there was no disruption at all once I kind of broached it. I think that because of that, I was able to create more experiences, you know, and widen my experiences that allowed me to gain that confidence to not drink in different situations. And not long after I quit drinking, or I stopped drinking, I took my dog interrailing across Europe. And there were a few times where I'd order alcohol-free beers in, I remember ordering one in Germany, and, you know, they went, but you're Scottish. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm not drinking. You know, and they're like, oh, cool. I thought everyone in Scotland drinks whiskey all the time. And I was like, no, I'm not drinking, you know. You know, so there, you know, there were things like that happened to me, you know, where I had to kind of broach these subjects, where I had to kind of break these stigmas. But, you know, I think for anyone who's listening, who is fearful of, you know, the disruption they'll cause, the disruption is in your head more than anything else. And I think that if anything, there's been positive pattern disruptions where people within my friend group have either taken time away from alcohol, or they reduce their alcohol intake because they're with me, right? So if we're off to watch football at the pub, they don't really want to be sitting there drinking alone. They'll have a Guinness Zero or something like that because they kind of are matching me, which is a really powerful thing, actually. Once you start experiencing that actually, like, you know, you are kind of de-influencing people. And I think that's a real nice thing that can help, like, boost your confidence a lot.
It is a lovely thing because you would sort of make a pact with yourself to never be that person who enforces your change on other people or throws judgment into a group or whatever, even comments. I'm so careful. I'm so careful about what I say and even my expressions and stuff when I go out. But it is, as you say, a very powerful thing when people kind of mirror, I suppose, for want of a better term, they begin to mirror your behavior a little bit. So I'm fascinated by why we overestimate the fallout, sort of why we imagine social consequences to be so much bigger than they are. And that's because I'm a bit nerdy on the whole, I suppose, the neuroscience and the behavioral science. So, you know, the truths that we can find in understanding how the brain is wired, you know, and how that wiring kicks in. So just indulge my nerdiness. Let me run through a few things, Ryan. And after each one, you can tell me if it sort of stacks up. Okay. So one of the reasons I think why we overestimate the fallout is because of this thing called sort of belonging anxiety. So at a very, very basic human nature level, we are wired to belong. I mean, hardwired. So, you know, social rejection historically has meant, you know, loss of protection, loss of status, loss of survival. So when someone considers not drinking in a drinking culture, the nervous system can actually interpret it as I'm stepping outside of the group. Yeah. Now you're lucky your friends didn't reject you, cast you out and send you off in exile. But it's a very real thing, isn't it? I mean, it's a worry that people have.
Yeah, definitely. I can understand. I mean, it was definitely a worry that I had, you know, because I guess there were so many parts of my personality, I think I defined by alcohol. And you know, I've got really close friends that we used to go to breweries together and we used to, you know, buy obscure beers and taste them together and share those kind of moments. And I guess when you're unable to do those things with that person, how is your friendship defined, you know, in a kind of post-alcohol kind of existence, you know? And I think that that is definitely a fear.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's, you know, it's a hard wiring, but I think from sort of a curiosity perspective, it makes that fear sort of less around alcohol. It's not the fear of not drinking so much as opposed to the being afraid of not belonging. To find more common ground, I'm going to have to belong in a different way is a big thing, I think.
Yeah, and it's because we create our friendships and bonds through alcohol, to be honest. You know, and well, that's the way we're kind of taught through media, through socialization, through lots of different ways. You know, that's how we kind of are, I guess, taught to connect with people is through these different ways. And when you remove the alcohol from the situation, or you decide you're not going to drink, you don't really get a toolkit on how to replace that, right? You know, no one, you know, you don't suddenly join the sobriety club and they send the toolkit through your door and go, oh yeah, no, this is how you be friends now. You know, you have to kind of learn those tools yourself, and that is really, it's frightening. It's, you know, and it's tough, but it's also a really beautiful part of becoming someone who doesn't drink, because you learn how to connect with people in a way that's so much deeper.
Yeah.
Because you don't have that, you know, that shield that you carry, I think.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I use the same sort of similar metaphor. I kind of always think it's like, you know, it's the glue. It's the glue that holds relationships together. It's glue that sort of relationships have been forged on. So what you're sort of worried about doing is picking away at it, you know, in case these things come unstuck. And you sort of think, well, what if it is the glue? What if that is all that it is holding it together? And I'm, well, first of all, sure that's the proper definition of a friendship. But then secondly, you find another way of cementing things. But I think that's cool. I think you've answered my question. The social belonging piece, it is definitely one of the reasons why we overestimate. The next one I'm going to chuck at you, because I like this one a lot, is it's this sort of principle of projection. We assume that others are going to judge us or feel threatened or think we're boring, you mentioned earlier, or think we have a problem. We assume all of these things, but what's happening there really is kind of projection. You know, when someone opts out, others may briefly reflect on their own thinking, and that moment of self-awareness can feel really uncomfortable, rather, and we can interpret that discomfort as judgment directed at us. But in reality, most people are far more preoccupied with themselves. That's what I've found. Do you know what I mean? They don't care ultimately. So in a way, we're sort of sometimes we're sort of saying it's, you know, we think we're fearing other people's judgment, but really it's our own self-consciousness. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think it's absolutely true, right, that we are our own worst enemy when it comes to this, right? Because we go in with all of these preconceived notions of what people are going to think or how they're going to behave towards us, when actually we're making a kind of mountain out of a molehill. Because like you said, people are much more interested in themselves than they are you, right? And I think the old adage, when you assume, it makes an ass of you and me, right? It's like we need to help people understand that those assumptions are totally false. And the only way to do it is to try it, you know, is to kind of experience it and then go through those motions more and more. And you'll realize that actually it's not really an issue. It's only an issue you've built up in your head. And I think that goes across the board, you know. I mean, it's like when, you know, any kind of social interaction, alcohol related or not, interviews, going to a party, whatever, we're concerned about what people will think about what we're wearing or what our hair's like, or, you know, all of these kind of things, right? And actually a lot of times it's nothing, you know, it isn't really something that's that important.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. So the third thing I was going to talk about, you know, why we overestimate the disruption we might be causing, is this human fear again that we have of literally standing out. So we are incredibly sensitive as human beings to kind of deviations from the norm. So, you know, when alcohol is expected, saying no feels like making a statement, even if you're not. And standing out in that way then sort of generates this sort of self-monitoring, hyper-awareness and, you know, anxiety about how we're being perceived. But in practice, and very true to your own experience, you know, most social groups recalibrate really, really quickly. And it's what the psychologists call a kind of a spotlight effect. We overestimate how much people notice us. And we imagine that the spotlight's on us. In reality, it's not even there, which I find fascinating. And it really does, you know, it makes us very, very sensitive about doing anything that stands out when, as I say, in reality, the spotlight isn't there at all. Okay, and then the last one I was going to talk about is this over-identification with a drinking culture. So, for example, in places with strong drinking identities, like Scotland, you know, alcohol is tied to things like, you know, masculinity or social credibility or being fun, as you said. And if you've got, you know, an identity that's connected to that, then it, you know, you're the one who can hold your drink, you know, you're the last one standing, or, you know, it's just what we do. And stepping away again can feel like really changing not just a habit but who you are, and it can feel existential. I mean, I'm not a Scottish bloke, I felt it in a kind of English only kind of way. Nothing dramatic happened, it was just ridiculous, but I suppose it did subconsciously make me think, well, who am I, you know, in this group, if I'm not Anna, the one who's always at the bar, or Anna, the one who's always last one standing, whatever, probably not last one standing, but last one trying to stand, you know, who am I? It's an identity thing, isn't it? It really is.
Yeah. And I mean, I saw something this week, actually, and it was from Lad Bible. It was a post that they put up, you know, and it was, you know, I guess the tie-in with Six Nations, right? And it was, which nation is the biggest drinkers, you know, Scotland, England, Wales, Ireland, you know.
Sounds like a Six Nation
and
piece, yeah.
Yeah, it's your kind of standard Six Nations kind of piece, right? And I guess it really made me think, like, there is such a perverse pride in the amount of alcohol you can imbibe in one session and, you know, what country you're from, you know? And I think if anything, it crosses. It's one of the things that is so international, right? Is like, who's the biggest drinker? Which is kind of mad, right? If you think about it, because, you know, I thought to myself, like, well, let's replace that with any drug, you know? Like, you know, would you be really proud if your country took the most heroin? You know, probably not, you know? And I mean, maybe there are parts of Glasgow that maybe, but, you know, that's a terrible thing to say. But in all seriousness, the who am I, the identity, you know, especially like the idea of masculinity and like, yeah, you can drink like X amount of pints because he's such a man, right? You know, it can lead to these existential crises, but it shouldn't. Because, you know, what we really need to think about is that when we stop drinking, we actually get to learn who we really are, right? And that is really uncomfortable. Right. Like it can be uncomfortable because you can be like, well, you know, you've avoided this for however many years that you've been drinking. Right. You've avoided actually having a personality because, you know, you kind of were able to mask that through drinking and kind of through the smoke of mirrors of everybody else drinking, you're able to mask it as well. And so there is probably a fear of like, you know, I've got to really present myself as a human to other people in social situations. And it is really fearful, but I will say, and this is something that I think probably does make people uncomfortable, especially in British culture, but like I truly love myself, right? Which is something that I probably wouldn't have been able to say for most of my life, right?
Beaten up in and for saying things like that.
Yeah, you know,
seriously, yeah. A lot of blokes be like, you what?
Yeah, 100%, you know, but I truly love myself and the reason that I can wholeheartedly say that is because like I have to sit with myself and be, you know, I have to always be me, right? I don't ever have to mask it. And, you know, I know that being in a social situation as myself, as Ryan, and turning up as me, that people do like me, they do enjoy me. I know I'm not perfect, right? I know I have flaws. But I'm okay to sit with those flaws, right? Because they are actually part of me. And the only way that I've been able to come to that kind of realization is because I don't drink anymore. And, you know, I can be so proud of myself that I've managed to go through this thing that very few people are able to do.
That is a really lovely thing and really nicely expressed. It's so true. When you don't drink and you're really popular, you're popular for being you. And you can 100% with confidence take that away. You know, not necessarily in a hugely inflated ego kind of way, but just in a surety, as you say, that, you know, who you are is cool, actually, and not perfect, but good enough.
Yeah, my you know, my flaws are acceptable enough for people to still want to spend time with me, you know, and I think it's one of these things that I think we maybe discount from the beauty of being alcohol free is that actually, you know, you have to turn up as you all the time, and you get to see that people enjoy spending time with you, not this fake kind of drink-fueled person. It's maybe different from your real, you know, personality, but actually you. And that can give you such a huge amount of confidence, because actually all of the reasons that we drink are things like, well, will people like me? Who am I? You know, all of these kind of anxieties. They can go out the window, because actually, no, your friends love you because you are the person who you are.
I love that. We could finish the episode there, but that wasn't what this episode's all about. We've got to go on, though. We've got to go on and look at the other side of it, because, you know, we've explored how much we overestimate the impact of not drinking. But as you began to sort of talk about earlier, we really, really underestimate or just choose to ignore because it's normal. The impact of drinking. So, and I mean the true impact. I'm because, you know, we know that of an evening in a bar, several rounds have been had. We know that people get more animated and the atmosphere changes and misunderstandings happen and all sorts of things that can create grounds for sort of skirmishes and things like that. But even that, in some ways, we kind of know that that's how things can go, and we normalize that, if you know what I mean. It's even that we sort of normalize. But I know through drink link, you see a darker side too. And as I say a darker side, because obviously we talked about this a bit when we first met, and you mentioned earlier, you know, deaths and A&E admissions and things like that. But what else do you see? What else becomes chaotic that you see through drink link?
I think when we get to the real extreme ends of alcohol use disorder, you know, dependency and people who are you know, suffering from alcoholism, the ripple effects are absolutely massive, right? So it's not just on that person, but it's that person's family is really affected, because
you work with the families, don't you?
Yeah. So what DrinkLink does is try to link people with services that can help them or their family members who suffer from alcohol use disorders. Mm-hmm. So that can be kind of counseling for the family members themselves. It could be counseling for the person who's suffering from alcohol. And it's, you know, it's because alcohol, when someone is an alcoholic or is having problems with alcohol, they can cause so much harm, you know, not just, I mean, physically, right? Through, you know, I mean, we know it has a massive impact on domestic abuse cases. I mean, one in three domestic abuse cases in Scotland involve alcohol, but the psychological nature of it as well, right? So it has generational effects. So people whose parents were alcoholics are much more likely to be alcoholics themselves. People will have effects, you know, it'll affect their own relationships. So they'll be more likely to go into relationships with people who, you know, have substance use problems. So to try and break some of those generational issues, you know, we want to try and link people with the services they need. And it's really disparate. Depending on what your geographic area is, you might have some services, and depending on where in Scotland you are. So we try and make those links, and also try and help people to know that there is help out there. They don't have to suffer in silence, because I think a lot of families do.
I'm listening and I'm thinking there's so many. You mentioned statistics, but I wouldn't be able to sort of reel them off now. But I've done podcast episodes before when we've looked at the hidden costs of drinking in the UK, for example. And I had a good friend, another alcohol coach, actually, a lady called Maria, who came onto the podcast, and she was an ex deputy superintendent of Midlands Police. I mean, she's very, very senior in the police, and she could talk with real authority about the chaos and disruption caused at a society level. And it is, you know, it's the domestic violence, it's the spikes in violence around the football matches, around the big events, you know, and this notion that somebody's welfare come an evening in a marriage relationship can depend on whether the football team has won or lost that day, or, you know, whether the national team's been knocked out of a championship and their partner comes home aggressive, disappointed, resentful, cross the whole lot, you know. And it's appalling. It's appalling when you think that outcomes like that depend on pure chance on a football pitch. And it's, you know, when you think about the chaos and the disruption that's actually wreaked through alcohol, I think it's tragic, and it's, you know, it's incredibly sad. But one of the things that you had mentioned to me before, Rye, was this notion of the impact on children in the home environment. And I don't mean the physical violent impact. I mean simply the sort of psychological impact of children for years and years and years sort of absorbing unpredictability or even having to become sort of young carers as a result. Yeah. So what do you see there?
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, exactly that. Children who are having to grow up a lot faster than they should, you know, missing out on opportunities because actually they have to take care of either a parent or another sibling or both. They're having to grow, you know, just grow up too fast because actually they are having to parent a parent because of alcohol. And it happens all too often. The wider impacts of lost opportunities. So one of the things that we try and do is employability schemes, you know, to try and help people gain skills in areas that they're interested in, because they actually might miss out. If you're unable to link into an internship or a program like that because actually you've had to take care of an alcoholic parent instead, it can really set you back. So, mm-hmm. you know, we try and link young people with people who work in a profession that they're interested in to try and get them a little bit of a foot in the door wherever possible, because actually they might have missed out on that opportunity because they were having to do something else that they shouldn't have had to.
It sounds like you're doing great work. It's vital work. It's just so sad that it's needed. Do you know what I mean? It's a reality. I know it is.
There's also like a massive kind of link with poverty as well, you know? So, you know, we know that alcohol death rates are 4.5 times higher in deprived areas of Scotland. It's not just that it's happening. It's that it's happening to people who are in the most deprived areas, and those most deprived children as well are also being impacted by it the most. And it's heartbreaking, actually, because if this was any other drug, it would be outlawed, you know, with the amount of impact that it has.
Yeah, without a shadow of a doubt. And it, you know, probably we could have a whole conversation around this on many other episodes, I'm sure. But it really does, for me, it sort of shifts that question, you know, at a societal level, really. Not just how, you know, from how much we drink to who it affects. It's a real eye-opener. Real eye-opener.
You know, when we start really thinking about who it impacts, Anna, it doesn't have to just be because you are someone who suffers from alcohol use disorder that your drinking is impacting people, right? People who are waking up on a Sunday and they're not able to follow through with their plans that they've made with their partner or with their children, you know, it's impacting them as well. So it's, you know, it's not just because you're drinking a bottle of vodka at night. It's actually maybe just because you're not being able to turn up for the people who you love. And it can be at any scale.
Well, it really can. One of the most common things I come up and talk to people about when, you know, I'm coaching them. They'll look back and they just say, I feel really guilty now. And I'm, you know, what's surfacing for you? And they talk about, you know, the fact that they just never felt they were particularly present for kids, or they haven't been a particularly hands-on parent. They've chosen other things over spending time, or they have literally been incapacitated, tired, low energy, hangovers, and had to delegate football clubs on Saturdays to their partner and stuff like that, and just felt that they haven't really been as good a parent, I suppose, is how they would phrase it. But, you know, again, I'm always very quick to say there's no judgment on these things, clearly. But it's, you know, it's a very common thing. So very, very quickly, right, because I'm really conscious of the time, you mentioned, we went into this episode talking about all the assumptions that we might have about how we're going to sort of disrupt our relationships, our social life. And you talked about the fact that you personally just said it's two months or 7 weeks or whatever it was you said it was going to be. It strikes me that, I mean, I know that that's a very good approach. It's one that's worked for a lot of people I've talked to. For me, it's a real opportunity to take all of your assumptions and all of your hypotheses and just test them out, you know, without any longer-term commitment. Is that all you effectively found yourself doing?
So, yeah, I think it was manageable. Because I said I was going to give up for this amount of time. And then when I got there, I was able to challenge myself to increase how long I was going, because I actually enjoyed it, you know, yeah. I enjoyed it, you know, and I thought, I've done 2 months, I can do another one. And then by the time that third month ended, I just thought, just see how long you can go. And it has brought me so much joy since I've given up drinking. I am a better son. I'm a better brother. I'm a better boyfriend to my girlfriend. You know, I'm even probably a better caregiver for my dog. You know, and it's opened up such a world of opportunities that keeping going has gotten easier and easier over time. Yeah. I think that if I'd said to myself, I'm never going to drink again, I think it would have definitely failed, because, you know, I would have sat myself in an absolute. But by just going that little bit further and that little bit further, it just became more and more manageable until there were so many good things. It was such a net positive that there's no reason for me to ever consider drinking alcohol again. You know, as I've said, I've not said that I'm not going to, right? There might be, and might be a situation where I do. But I think by keeping that door a little bit open, it just means that I'm able to kind of go through life thinking that, you know, this is a game almost. I've gamified it, right? Let's just see how long I can go.
I love that. But it is, you know, I always talk about terminology like curiosity and experimentation. And, you know, it's a chance to acknowledge that you've got assumptions and actually your brain is wired in certain ways. So you're bound to have those assumptions, but actually test it out. And, you know, and 99% of the time, in 99% of cases, you know, you realize that the assumptions were wrong, that the impact of changing is purely positive, and all those assumptions get replaced by hard evidence, which is, you know, the surety that you're on the right track, which is a beautiful thing. Very good. Okay, well, right, thank you. I really appreciate the conversation, you know, the reminder that opting out of alcohol is never as socially disruptive as we fear. I think that's going to be very reassuring food for thought for a lot of listeners, but also your insight, especially through the work that you do with DrinkLink, that despite it being normalized in society, alcohol is actually the big disruptor in ways that we probably don't consider every day. So thank you. Thank you for the work that you do. Thank you for this conversation. It's been an absolute pleasure. How can people get hold of you?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. I reached out to you and you decided to let me come on. I must say thank you. It's really lovely to chat. I really, really enjoy it. But the best thing that anyone could do is actually, if they would follow us on Instagram,
yep,
at DrinkLink Charity, give us a follow and please take a look at what we do. What I really love doing is I love hearing stories about why people came to sobriety. And I like to make videos with people and hear all their stories. So if there are people out there listening and they would like to be featured, then please drop us a DM and we can arrange something.
Amazing. Well, we'll put the link in the show notes. And hopefully people get in touch. Sounds a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It was. It's cool. And it's, you know, it's the positive side, isn't it? That we should focus on. I mean, we talk about some grisly stuff as well, but that sounds brilliant. I love that you do that. All right. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming on, and we'll speak again soon.
Thank you. It's great speaking to you.
Thank you for listening and getting curious. Please rate, review, and follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you're choosing to listen. It really helps other people find the show. And don't forget to tune in to the next episode. And you can find all of my resources and become part of the Big Drink Rethink by heading to my website, thebigdrinkrethink.com.